This is Paris at midnight. It's been a great day for the moving and packing industry in Paris. At the time of the Battle of the Marne in 1914, the Germans were equally close to the city. I don't know how many more radio broadcasts can be made from the Paris studio.
After all these years, it is still in the remembering a remarkable event, the fall of Paris in 1940. It was June and the Germans were coming. I was in the French capital reporting for CBS. I remember my final reports from Paris. The government was leaving, so were many of the people, and so would I. About a quarter century passed before I heard recordings of those old Paris broadcasts. Bob Trout and I sat in a studio one day playing the tapes, and I talked a bit about how it had been in that June.
That last day I was in Paris, there was a cloud of black smoke way to the north, creeping toward Paris. I think some oil dumps or something had been set on fire. This was very symbolic. The whole horizon began to darken and close toward the city, and looking up to the Champs-Élysées, great boulevard, there was hardly a car left. I noticed one waiter out putting the chairs from a cafe back inside. No one sitting there. The life just simply ran out of the city. It was like a beautiful woman lying in a coma, you know, with her life blood just draining out from every vein, every street.
World War II was radio journalism's passage to maturity. We had had news by radio for years before that, but nothing prior to the war made comparable demands. It is 1939, and Austria and Czechoslovakia already are gone to Hitler. On September 1st, Germany invades Poland, and France and Britain are on the edge of war with Hitler. With the ripening threat of bombs falling, the British act. We hear again the voices of that action, voices of children, a teacher, a trainside reporter, and the explaining voice of Robert Trout.
Great Britain has begun the evacuation of its mothers and children, its crippled and its blind. 3 million of those too weak to fight or to help are being moved from the so-called target areas of the large cities to sanctuaries in the British countryside. It is the greatest mass migration in all history. Now, to give you a first-hand account of this evacuation, Columbia calls in London and hears from Mr. Joly de Lobinier, head of the outside broadcast department of the British Broadcasting Corporation. We take you now to London.
But on number 12 platform at Waterloo Station, one of the 10 big metropolitan stations that are engaged today on the evacuation of London's school children. The train's in and the children are just arriving. I'd like to try and find one of the teachers who's going with them.
Yes.
Are you going with them?
Yes.
Tell us now how many you've got to look after here.
I've got 141 children and 16 people helping. They've come from one of the poorest districts in London, very near the famous Elephant and Castle, which no doubt many people have heard. They're all merry and bright. We haven't had a single child crying. And now I think really in my heart they're looking forward to this little adventure because many of them have never seen the country before. We're very grateful for all that's been done for us. And to all those who've helped us, we say thank you from the bottom of our heart.
1 minute. The train's leaving in 1 minute. Is it? Well, now, children, come on. Give them a song as you go.
Hip, hip. Come on now. Hip, hip.
September 1st, 2 days later, the British and the French went to war with Germany. Ed Murrow was director of talks for CBS in those days of the late 30s when war was infiltrating Europe. He was asked to go to Europe for CBS, and he did, traveling about, covering stories, hiring me and other reporters to tell about the war. Murrow put his roots down in Great Britain. The wartime broadcast that began This is London told America of the British fight for survival. Murrow worked in the Blitz, including in his stories the vignettes about how people lived at war. He brought listeners to his rooftop during an air raid, September 22nd, 1940.
The plane is still very high, and it's quite clear that he's not coming in for his bombing run. Earlier this evening, we could hear occasionally, again, those were explosions overhead. Earlier this evening, we heard a number of bombs go sliding and slithering across to fall several blocks away. Just overhead now, the burst of the anti-aircraft fire. Still, the nearby guns are not working, and the searchlights now are feeling almost directly overhead. Now you'll hear two bursts a little nearer in a moment. There they are. That hard, stony sound.
Ed Murrow, against the wishes of the people he worked for, went along on bombing runs over Germany. His account of a raid December 3rd, 1943, became known as Orchestrated Hell.
The bomb doors were open. Boz called his directions. Five left, five left. And then there was a gentle, confident upward thrust under my feet, and Boz said, "Cookie gone." A few seconds later, the incendiaries went, and D-Dog seemed lighter and easier to handle. I began to breathe and to reflect again that all men would be brave if only they could leave their stomachs at home. I looked on the fourth beam at the target area. There was a red, sullen, obscene glare. The fires seemed to have found each other, and we were heading home. Berlin was a kind of orchestrated hell, a terrible symphony of light and flame.
Near the end of the war, Murrow was with the first Allied reporters to enter the concentration camp at Buchenwald. In his report, he suggested that listeners who didn't wish to hear about such things should turn off their radios.
As we walked out into the courtyard, a man fell dead. The two others, they must have been over 60, were crawling towards the latrine. I saw it, but will not describe it. In another part of the camp, they showed me the children, hundreds of them. Some were only six. One rolled up his sleeve, showed me his number. It was tattooed on his arm. D-6030 it was. The others showed me their numbers. They will carry them till they die. We proceeded to the small courtyard. There were two rows of bodies stacked up like cordwood. They were thin and very white. I tried to count them as best I could, and arrived at the conclusion that all that was mortal of more than 500 men and boys lay there in two neat piles. It appeared that most of the men and boys had died of starvation. They had not been executed. But the manner of death seemed unimportant. Murder had been done at Buchenwald.
Those of us who started in this broadcast business with the coming of the Second World War, and I was one of them, quickly learned that our words had been conscripted to serve the telling of great events. For all the years until it was over, and when it was over, to tell of that ending. By May of 1945, Hitler and Mussolini were dead, Italy had given up, and it was Germany's turn. The German High Command sent Colonel General Alfred Jodl to treat with General Walter Beadle Smith, Eisenhower's chief of staff, and America's allies in the war room of the Red Schoolhouse Allied headquarters at Brans in France. Early the 7th of May, it was done. Charles Collingwood was there.
About 2:30 in the morning, General Tui Spatz walks in. He is followed in quick succession by the Russians. Then Air Marshal Robb comes in, Admiral Burrow. Pretty soon, Beadle Smith himself enters, the man who bore the brunt of the long hours of negotiation. Then the Germans come in. Jodl's face is like a death mask, drawn, unnatural-looking, and with every muscle in it clenched. They reach the table, bow in unison, and wait. General Smith motions them to sit down. Everyone sits down. Jodl signs the surrender at 2:41, and then General Smith, who hands it to the Russian General Soslaparov, and finally the French General Seves, signs it. By 2:45, the last signature has been affixed. Then came the most dramatic moment of all. Everything had been signed. There was no longer any possibility of quibbling or evasion. The German Third Reich, which had once made the world to tremble, had collapsed in blood-stained fragments. Colonel General Jodl, Chief of Staff of the German Army, asked General Beadle Smith's permission to speak. He stood up stiffly, like a man holding himself in against some unbearable pain. In a strangled voice, like a sob, he said, "With this signature, the German people and the German armed forces are, for better or worse, delivered into the victor's hands. In this hour, I can only express the hope that the victor will treat them with generosity."
Germany surrendered in May. Now it was August 45. Atomic bombs fell on Hiroshima on the 6th and Nagasaki on the 9th. Now it was the 14th, and Bob Trout had waited in the CBS newsroom for days for this hour.
7 p.m. Eastern wartime. Bob Trout reporting. "The Japanese have accepted our terms fully. That's the word we've just received from the White House in Washington. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War. The United Nations, on land, on the sea, in the air, and to the four corners of the earth, are united and are victorious."
In May 1951, CBS assigned a new man to report what was called the Korean police action, but was actually the Korean War. Robert Pierpoint was 25 years old when he was sent to the front. With him, he took a tape recorder, and on that recorder, he gathered the sounds of war and his initiation into battle. He was on the front lines for the first time, feeling a compelling need to know what was going on out there and down the hill from him, where he could see flames in the darkness and hear gunfire. Pierpoint asked, an American captain answered.
What's that outfit down there, Captain?
That's enemy patrols down in there.
Where are those fires burning?
That is napalm or poo gases set off by artillery that we've had placed out there during the day.
Mm-hmm. What's this small arms fire off here to our left?
That's a patrol working around Charlie Company.
What's that?
That's a VT barrage, artillery VT, trying to knock out an enemy machine gun nest that's working its way up towards our Charlie Company on our left flank.
Mm-hmm. Liable to be sorry they ever got into this.
We're liable to be sorry we ever got into this.
That one went off right above us, didn't it?
Little did he know. Listen to what happened next. In the trade, it's called a short round, a flawed or misaimed shell that fails to go the distance, dropping close to or among friendly troops. It happened to Pierpoint that night. On this recording, you'll hear the whoosh overhead, the explosion, and then Pierpoint.
We have just hit the dirt. I don't know whether this tape is still going, but I'm awful low right now. What was that came over?
That was artillery. Dropped right there.
Tell them to raise that thing.
Tell them to raise that thing, Pierpoint says to the captain. The captain tells them.
This is 5-3. Request that element firing on my left, in the area immediately to my left, lift his fire. It is coming very, very close to our position.
Not all war is shot and shell, as Pierpoint discovered. There were communist attacks all along the front as Pierpoint arrived that night. The next morning, a counterattack was being prepared, and he heard something besides a sound of war.
Strangely enough, above the roar of the artillery and the whine as the shells go overhead, we can hear the whistle of the early morning birds.
Robert Pierpoint's introduction to war in 1951. It is not unusual in this business to find yourself far from home and your normal beat. September 1965, and Winston Burdett was in Kashmir, though Rome and the Mediterranean are usually his home grounds. But an undeclared war had broken out between India and Pakistan over long-contested Kashmir, and Burdett was sent to report that war. September 16th.
I am sitting in a darkened room in a blacked-out city. There is an air raid. The city is Jammu, a frontier town of about 120,000 people, the winter capital of Kashmir. We're about 16 miles from the fighting front, where the Indian Army has stopped the main Pakistani drive into Kashmir. The Pakistani planes that are now over the city are probably F-86 Sabre jets. The Pakistanis are using the Sabre jets as all-purpose planes. They use them to strafe at the front, to fire rockets at Indian military targets, like airfields, and to rocket or bomb various places behind the front, like Jammu. The Indians have an odd assortment of AK-AK guns, old and new. Old-fashioned ones, the Bofors, that are aimed visually. The red tracer lights ascending slowly in an arc into the night sky. And then some new guns, very fast, very fierce, leaving a white trail. Tonight is an ideal raiding night. No clouds, and a full moon. Here in this room, we've covered the windows partly with blankets and partly with black paper tacked to the window frames. The air raids in this war are unlike any others in recent war experience. They are not mass raids. Apparently, the purpose of the raids, like this one, is mainly to spread alarm and despondency and panic. There is no end in sight. CBS News in Jammu, Kashmir.
UN Secretary General U Thant visited Indian Pakistan as they fought over Kashmir in September of 65. Later, he reported to the Security Council, which asked for an end to the conflict. Ceasefire started on the 23rd, a week after the air raid Burdett talked about in Jammu. On June 4th, 1967, Israel decided that her Arab neighbors were preparing to storm over her borders and try to wipe her off the map. So it was decided that Israel would strike first. Michael Elkins was reporting for CBS News from Jerusalem, and on that beginning morning, June 5th, he was on the phone to New York calling in a report on the opening of war. Suddenly, as he spoke, hostilities came to Jerusalem, to Michael Elkins' doorstep.
You can hear the machine gun fire. This is a full-scale battle. There are bullets hitting past down below the junction of Jaffa Road. There are bullets hitting past, and people have fallen down, lying in the street. They are apparently not hit, but they are lying down. There goes the clump of a heavy shell, and there's a lady. Fantastic. There's a nice blonde lady, about 45 years old, who is strolling across this main street, which is under fire, and she just lifted her hand to me in a salute and has calmly walked very carefully along the pedestrian zone. She is not going to jaywalk. And there's one limping elderly man walking calmly with his beret on his head and a cane, just walking calmly across the very field of fire. Hold on.
Lachmisham! Lachmisham!
Well, he's going to get himself knocked off. I've just shouted to him to get out of the way. Whoop. Hold on a minute. Hold on. Hello, New York. Hello, New York. Please hang on. Please keep recording. This machine gun fire opened up just where I'm standing, near where I'm standing. I have to get out of the way. Whoa.
Elkins did get out of the way and went on to report that war that had broken out so close. By week's end in early June 1967, the war was over and Israel had smashed the armed forces of her hostile neighbors, taking territory from them, leaving the Middle East in a different and angry shape. Indochina's wars in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia attracted an army of news people who, like soldiers, served tours of duty and sometimes were killed, wounded, or captured. At one time or another, most of my colleagues at CBS News have spent time in the war zone. War has many impacts, for example, all those figures telling how many have died and how many tons of bombs have been dropped. But there's also the impact of one story about one soldier, Morley Safer, under fire.
The boy was hit by sniper fire while patrolling the hill. He lay in the grass, and the sniper kept the medics away from him. One of his buddies was wounded trying to get him up. And finally, he was pulled down. And finally, a second medevac helicopter came through the curtain of bullets to take him up. And just as the medevac came in, the boy died. He was 17.
Air power was supposed to be a decisive element in America's favor, and the favorite target of American air power was the Ho Chi Minh supply trail. Year after year, U.S. planes and South Vietnam's planes raided that pipeline, and Murray Frompson went along on one mission.
And here we go now, down on top of the trail. Right on it. Now here's the popping. Pull up to the field as he pulls. And away go the bombs. The pull is up. Oh, can we feel it? Let loose. And there's a big puff of smoke down there on the road where Captain Cook has just let loose a couple of his 500-pounders.
On the ground, there were those very personal moments when you, the reporter, were locked in a one-to-one relationship with a man with a gun trying to kill you, Richard Threlkeld.
Charlie, the sniper is still there. And you can hear the reports of his shots, at least I can. The bullets whine a few feet over our heads. Just to let you know, he's still around. We finally made it from this open field to the edge of this clearing to the tree line, and no tree line, no scrub of palm trees has ever looked quite so good, because We now have this line of trees between us and the sniper.
This war, as other wars, had its terrorism, its massacres, and as other wars, it had its mistakes. One day, Peter Kalischer was out in the field and found himself in the middle of an error.
The road is empty. It's mighty lonely looking. This is it.
4-4,
2-3, ambush on the right side. Take a look at the far. Just hit on the road here, about 500 meters from the landing zone. Infantry's coming up.
They're all wearing those black pajamas, over.
There was about five AC personnel on the right. When I went up to check the defile, they fired on me. We returned the fire. I don't know if we got any hits or not.
It seems there's been a terrible mistake. An intelligence squad was in the woods here when the leading element of our recon company came through. They fired on us, we fired back, and two of them are wounded.
The Americanization of Vietnam and the Vietnam War escalated in the 60s until a 500,000 U.S. troops were out there. Late in the decade, that involvement declined. We were heading for withdrawal. There were bombers over North Vietnam and talks in Paris. The 60s had passed and the 70s were getting older. January 27th, 1973, John Lawrence.
It is mid-afternoon now in Paris, and at midnight the ceasefire is to take effect. It'll be 8 o'clock Sunday morning in Saigon and Hanoi, in Tay Ninh and Quang Tri, at Da Nang and Hue and Hoi An, in the delta cities of My Tho and Can Tho, at remote outposts like Gio Linh, Khe San, and An Lac, in all the devastated villages, the bomb-cratered rice paddies, and defoliated forests, and in the tiny hamlet of My Lai 4. Across Vietnam, for the first time in 13 years, the shooting will stop.
At first, the events at My Lai 4 in South Vietnam in March of 68 were hidden from public view. But the dimensions of the event were too great, and too many people knew what had happened. So eventually the whole world knew that American soldiers had killed civilians by the score, by the hundreds. One of the Americans there that day was Paul Meadlow. In 1969, he talked about the massacre with Mike Wallace. He told of finding civilians, not enemy troops, in the village. He told of being ordered by his platoon leader, Lieutenant William Calley, to gather the villagers together and then to kill them. Meadlow about Calley.
We stepped back about 10, 15 feet, and he started shooting them. And he told me to start shooting them. So I started shooting them. I fired about four clicks into it, to the group. I carried 17 rounds to each clip.
So you fired something like 60, 70
right.
shots. And you killed how many at that time?
Well, I fired them on automatic, so you just spray the area on them, so you really can't know how many you kill because it comes out so doggone fast. So I might have killed about 10 or 15 of them.
Mm-hmm. Men, women, and children?
Men, women, and children.
And babies?
And babies.
Okay, then what?
So we started to gather them up, and more people, and we had about seven or eight people that was going to put into a hooch, and we was going to throw a hanger net down with them. And somebody...
Wait a minute. Now you're rounding up more.
We're rounding up more, and we had about seven or eight people. And we was going to throw them in a hooch. And, we put them in a hooch, and we was going to throw a hanging aid down with them. And somebody hauled over from a ravine and told us to bring them over to the ravine. So we took them back out and led them over there to the to a ravine. And by the end of the time we already had them over there, they had about 70, 75 people all gathered up. So we threw ours in with them, and Lieutenant Kelly told me, said, Milo, we got another job to do. And so he walked over to the people and he started pushing them off and started shooting them.
What, pushing them off into the ravine?
Off into the ravine. It was a ditch.
No.
So then all together we just pushed them all off and just started using automatics on them. And then...
Again, men, women, children.
Men, women, and children.
And babies.
And babies.
In 1971, Lieutenant Kelly was convicted of murder at My Lai. One day after My Lai, Paul Meadlow stepped on a landmine. It blew off his foot. He told Mike Wallace he felt he was being punished for what he had done.